The White Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the November 7th, 2013 edition of The Heretics Hour. This is an 11-11 day, and I always like to pay attention to those 11s. Before I get into my very ugly main topic tonight, I want to express my regret at the death of Harold Rome, which occurred last night. I have not been able to find anything out on the internet, still even this evening, but I did receive an email this morning from Michael Santomaro, actually was sent out to a list, saying that, telling us about this sad news, saying it was from Harold's wife. He had received the message from Harold's wife, and that Harold had just died that night. But I don't see anything on the internet yet, and I don't know that Harold didn't have a website of his own, I guess. Maybe the family is pretty unhappy about it, you know, I mean, pretty sad about it, and not being able to put out too much more information. But anyway, I hope I'm not making a mistake in saying this, but I thought I'd pass it on and let people know, you know, I'm sure I'm not the only one at all who I'm sure everybody who knew Harold would say that every communication they had with him was pleasant. He certainly was always so very pleasant with me. And while I never did have him on as a guest on my programs, it just wasn't the kind of information that I was too interested in. Harold was one of the first people in this movement, in this wide generalized, you know, movement that contacted me long time ago because of an article of mine that he saw. And it was really, really made me feel good. And he's been a general kind of a off and on contact or friend ever since. So, it's really sad when one of our own passes away and we no longer have the benefit of their presence and their wisdom and their contributions. But I will probably have more to say next week about Harold. I'll find out more about him. And it is also Veterans Day today in the United States, but there's hardly any attention given to it as far as I can see. And I think it's because veterans are not very popular anymore and nobody thinks much, you know, good about them, even though it's not their fault. But it's because our wars are so vile and we have nothing to be proud of. And, you know, there's nothing good about our armed forces either. So I think they actually play it down because of that, the government even. I don't know if Obama did anything about it. And so going on now to tonight's main topic, which is the great art discovery in Germany. And, you know, it's more interesting than some of you may think that it is. It's about hidden paintings that were thought to have been destroyed in the Dresden bombing. Or that is the story anyway, given by the person who has been in possession of all these paintings all along. In my thinking is that just bringing up the Dresden bombing ought to be enough to ameliorate the blame heaped on the Nazis, quote unquote, but it is not. You know, it seems that stealing works of art is considered the far greater crime than asphyxiating, burning, and dissolving into ether, that is, 100,000 people who are civilians. Just let that sink in to understand what kind of a world we live in and what kind of people we are being ruled by. So that brings me up to something I was going to mention after a little bit later on, but I think I'll say it right now, and that is talking about President Barack Obama. last Saturday, I wanted to mention this, but didn't have time, but so it fits in quite well tonight. I don't know if you caught that little story. It was in the, it came out from the Washington Times, which is a conservative newspaper, one of the very few, but it's not anti-Jewish. Obama is reported as having said to his aides, in an off unguarded moment, "I'm really good at killing people." That's Obama. "I'm really good at killing people," he said. Anyway, here's a story. He was overheard bragging to administration aides about his ability to kill people with drones. And this is in a new book about the 2012 campaign season. That is, you know, the last presidential campaign when he got reelected, which he shouldn't have gotten reelected, but then, you know, there was nobody good to vote for. But that book is due for release, they said, on Tuesday. Now, maybe that was last Tuesday, or maybe tomorrow. But the president's specific words, it says, is, "I'm really good at killing people." And this comes from the authors of the book, Mark Halperin and John Heilemann. And I've heard of Mark Halperin, and I think he's a fairly well-known Washington reporter, I guess. And they write, the book's title is Double Down, Game Change 2012. This is probably just good publicity for the book, so people will go out and buy it. But the Daily Mail reported this, and they supposedly got this, what they're claiming, from a Washington Post report that buried the statement as a brief anecdote in an article in which the president is described as speaking to aides about the drone program and then making the claim that he is reported to have to have said that to them. And going on, Mr. Obama reported this reported statement comes at a time of increasing criticism for his use of drones in Pakistan and Yemen. The Bureau of Investigative Journalism in London reports that Mr. Obama has given approval for 326 drone strikes. And since 2004, drones have killed between 2,500 and 3,600, 950 of which these numbers are considered civilians. So this is what this organization claims. The White House says those figures are incorrect, but has not released their own statistics. The book's claims are even more interesting when it's remembered that Mr. Obama was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2009 for his extraordinary efforts to bolster democracy around the world. Well, we want to keep in mind, who are the really guilty parties during tonight's program? Because, you know, this is when this man, you know, can order these drone strikes and he can kill this many people. Now, I was going to mention 2004. That was when George Bush was reelected. So you've got 4 years of Bush. But I read that the drone attacks ordered by Bush are very small compared to what Obama has ordered. So the majority of all these, the vast majority, are under Obama. So let's say at least a minimum of 2,500 people killed in these drone strikes by President Obama. All right. I just want to mention, because it came up today, that Hotmail is still an issue for me. If you have a Hotmail email address, I've said this before, but it bears repeating once in a while. If you have a Hotmail email address, I cannot send emails from Carolyn Yeager, carolyn@carolynyeager.net to you. They always come back to me. And it seems that sometimes my my mailer from carolynyeager.net that I send out. I send one out for Heretics Hour and in advance of Heretics Hour and Saturday afternoon show, and I send out some others once in a while, something that I think is one of the more important things that I post at my website. And also I send out things that I post at Elie Wiesel Cons the World to people on this list of mine, and I have going on 400 people on my list, but there's a lot of Hotmail addresses, and I've been told by some people with Hotmail addresses that they don't get them, that they're not getting them. So just be aware of that. If you have something other than Hotmail, email other than Hotmail, you can subscribe with that one, and then you'll get the mailer. Otherwise, change your email. I guess Hotmail has really good security, but they have such good security that they apparently, I saw on this last one that came back, that they will not, that there's some part of my internet service provider from this email account that they block. Not all of it, but part of it, it says. So I don't really understand that, truthfully, what that is, because I'll just continue. You know, back when I wasn't on my own server and I was on somebody else's server that had, you know, shared with several things, I started having a lot of trouble with my mailer going out. And that was because, I was told, it was because the address of the server and my address weren't the same, so that was like, they don't like that, you know, it's like there's a question about where that's coming from, and it's not all kosher, so then they, you know, they don't accept it. So once I got on my very own server, that issue went away, and I was not having any trouble with Hotmail. But then it started up again. So I don't know what their problem is, but I have a hate relationship with Hotmail for that reason. But to go on, what have I got here? Oh, yeah, well, that's something I won't have time for. Art looting. I've got a lot of good information tonight about these paintings that they're trying to make out were stolen by the Nazis. This horde of paintings that's been found. 1,400 works of art. 14, that's a lot. 1,400 were found in a Munich apartment, a couple weeks ago. No, a lot longer ago. But it just, the news just leaked out. They've been working. I'll get to all this. So they've had these for maybe almost 2 years or a year and a half or so. But they have kept it hushed up, and that's part of the criticism of the Germans people who have been handling this. today, this morning, I guess it was, overnight, someone named Frank sent me about five emails with articles about this, and I found them very good articles. And then I wrote and thanked him, and he wrote back, and in the course of that let me know that he sent them to me because they were from the Wall Street Journal, and that's a subscription. You know, they're all subscription, so if you're not a subscriber and you're not paying for it, you don't get these. And these are the best ones I've read. They're very informative. So I was really grateful, told him that, I wasn't a subscriber of the Wall Street Journal, online there, and that, anything that looked good from there, go ahead and send me. I thought he might be the Frank that used to call at the, Voice of Reason, called me quite a few times. But he's not that same Frank, for anybody who might also be thinking that. But he is very nice Frank. So I want to, I'm going to be using this tonight, but I'm starting out with what was on Yahoo, one of the more recent ones on Yahoo, and I'll just go through some of the highlights here because it gives the background of what we're talking about. And that is, I already mentioned that there's 1,400 artworks that were found in a Munich apartment. And they write, in the chaotic aftermath of World War II, the American military seized 20 boxes of art from German dealer Hildebrand Wurlitt in Aschbach in December 1945. And this was according to documents located by the Associated Press in the U.S. National Archives in Washington. So this is an Associated Press article. So this art dealer Hildebrand Gurlitt had all of his art seized by the Americans, but they were seizing everything then. Let's remember who are the biggest looters that ever existed on this planet, well, in modern days. And that was the victorious Allies immediately following their victory in May of 1945 over Germany and its allies. And what allies it had left, really not much. Not much in the way of allies, Germany, Austria. And so they looted, they seized and stole everything possible that there was to steal between especially the United States, but Britain was competing with the United States and getting to things first. they suddenly became competitors, you know, in finding all the German treasures and so on. And then the Russians were also doing it, and then the French too, getting whatever they could get their hands on. And it went on and on and on. So, and we know that Germany was totally and completely looted, in short order, but certainly after a couple of years, including their best brains were commandeered and taken to their respective countries to serve the interests of those countries. So, this is the background, but here now we have another outbreak of talking about how the Nazis stole art, and mostly they stole it from Jews. You know, oh, they stole the Jews' artworks when they were forcing them to emigrate or leave the country or flee, or they were sending them to concentration camps. So it goes on to say that this Gurlitt, who was a German who had a Jewish, well, I guess his son says his son has a Jewish grandmother, so he must have had a Jewish mother. Something like that. But he was known. He was an art dealer. They were almost all Jews, part Jews. But there are reasons that he was working for the National Socialist regime because they had to deal with art and they needed art experts to do it. So he was working with them and in the 1930s. And these let's see. They eventually decided, the American investigators eventually decided from this art that they took from this Gurlitt that in most cases he was the rightful owner. So in 1950, December, they returned 206 items to him, 115 paintings, 19 drawings, and 72 various other objects. This is the history of it. And, now they've only shown at this point in time, and this was written, this came out, well, there's no date on it, a week ago or so. They had only shown three pictures of three of these artworks. And they say that, how they were in the apartment of this, Hildebrand Gurlitt's son, whose name is Cornelius. And he's been kind of hiding them away. He hasn't admitted that he had them. The story was, and this would have been given by his father originally, that they were in Dresden. And when Dresden went through that terrible bombing, he said he claimed that all the artwork that he had was lost. All his paintings and all his art collection was destroyed. And he moved somewhere else, away from Dresden, of course. But it wasn't, because now Cornelius has had all these paintings in this apartment of his, and he knew how to take care of them properly, or maybe that was the setup that his father had originally set up. But they are very well cared for, and he had racks, I guess, proper storage for them and so on. And they were hidden away, and once in a while he would sell one for money. You know, I mean, yeah, to get money, and he lived well, had plenty of money. But he didn't live like a millionaire or a billionaire. He just had, you know, they say when he had a bank account of about $650,000. And so that's some kind of a crime for an ordinary German person to have a bank account of $650,000. There's nothing wrong with that, you know. The three paintings that had been revealed, although before we come to the end of this, we're going to find out that they've been pressured to reveal many more of them. But at this time, they were not wanting to. It was a painting by Max Liebermann, a Jew, who was a Impressionist-type painter in Germany and during the Third Reich. And he was left alone. He was not molested at all by the Hitler or the regime. Have some of that, some things about him written in some of that material from Ein Anderer Hitler, the memoir of Hermann Giesler, on my website. But then there was also Otto Dix, who was a well-known German expressionist. And then they also showed some more paintings than that, but the only ones they mentioned here is by Marc Chagall. I saw the small image of the Marc Chagall painting. He was a Russian who actually lived in Paris, and Jew. I guess Otto Dix. I'm not sure if Otto Dix is Jewish or not. I forgot to look that up. But the Chagall didn't look like a good one. And you have to understand, I mean, I'm sure many of you do understand, I'm going to make this point, though, that just because a work of art has one of these famous names on it, you know, that have become well known and accepted as somehow creators of masterpieces in art history, in the art world, doesn't mean that everything that they ever did was a masterpiece. It sure wasn't. And that's, you know, true of every artist. You're going to have, they're creating stuff all the time, and some of it just, you know, sucks and doesn't come off that well. And the best ones, they're not always the best, but what's considered the best ones get sold, and they get well known, and they're, you know, end up being exhibited and being sometimes bought by museums and so on. And then they have this reputation. And then after they get a big, big reputation, every single thing that's ever found with their name on it that can be verified it was by them, it becomes worth a whole lot of money. Even though it's really just something that they, you know, set aside, it didn't quite work out. You know, it doesn't mean that it's any good. And that's the absolute truth about that. So they give us a bunch of names, you know. I don't need to go into that. And there were a lot of these are in the modern degenerate, what the Nazis considered, the quote-unquote Nazis considered degenerate art. And all of these famous artists, famous today, Matisse, Picasso, Renoir, Kokoschka, and Dix, Liebermann, that I already mentioned, and Ernst Ludwig Kirchner, who is a German expressionist, they would all have been in the degenerate category by the National Socialists. Even Renoir, I think, because I'm not so sure they wouldn't be so much against Renoir, but they wouldn't have liked him all that much. So that's this little article. This is has, you know, got to say a few things I wanted to say here. And but the one thing I want to point out, that this article is written by Kirsten Grieshaber and David Rising. And then it says at the end of the article that AP investigative researcher Randy Hirschaft contributed from New York. Well, I have, you know, I see this Randy Hirschaft. I see this line about Randy Hirschaft being, you know, contributing to this article and that article fairly often. And they're always articles having to do with Holocaust and National Socialism and Nazis and Nazi crimes and so on. And in fact, when I was doing, looking into those, that interview by that woman Dobnik, I can't think of her first name, that AP reporter who's like, I think she's from Slovakia or something. She's in the United States now, probably an American citizen now, but she writes a lot of this stuff, and she did this interview with Elie Wiesel, where she's the one who said that Elie Wiesel showed her, pulled up his shirt sleeve and showed her his tattoo while she was interviewing him. But yet, no pictures, no further comment about it, just that. And that one too, she was, you know, was contributed to with, from Randy Hirschaft. And then I looked up her history, and, she did all kinds of work with this Randy Hirschaft, and all of his stuff, and a lot of her stuff all has to do with German Nazis and World War II crimes and, you know, Holocaust and stuff. So I think the job of this Randy Hirschaft is that, that these people, these reporters are given the job. They write the article, and then it goes to Randy Hirschaft. And he looks it over, and he adds anything that needs to be added, you know, or to make it sound even worse. There was something in this one that I figured came from here. Oh, yeah, it's this meaningless sentence. It says, Gurlitt, speaking about this man with the paintings, Gurlitt had worked closely with the Nazi regime in the 1930s to sell art it considered degenerate to fill its war coffers. You know, further down in the Wall Street Journal articles, they said something very similar, that he worked with the Nazis in the 1930s to sell art. It said I forget what it says. I'm going to come to it, though. But like to support the state or to help the finances, the state finances. They were selling some of this art that they thought was no good, but there was a market for it in the world. And they owned it, you know. It was from their own museums. It was from Germany's museums. They didn't steal it. And they had every right to sell it, since they were the government, and the government culture minister said, well, we think that these are not good paintings to be in Germany, and, you know, they belong to the state, really. They belong to state museums. So they could sell them, and they were trying to sell them because they didn't want them. And, but see, in this article, with Randy Hirschaft's help, he probably added that. I'm just, you know, speculating, but I think it makes sense. He probably added that to fill its war coffers. That's the kind of thing that they like to add, and they like to, you know, and when you see that, all this stuff put in these articles, it's some editor who knows all about that and knows how to do it, and this Randy Hirschaft is a Jew, too. And so is this Dobnik woman, I'm sure, from Slovakia, who writes similar things. So, all right, now, this I found really interesting, that is from the PBS. It's an interview by a Jonathan Petropoulos, Greek name, and he is professor of history at Claremont McKenna College and a specialist in Nazi art, looting, and restitution. Now, you know he must be Jewish. He's got this Greek name, but, you know, he's probably a Greek Jew, and or a Jew who's from Greece and taken on Greece, Greek name. But, you know, he to get ahead, he's decided to specialize in something. So he specialized in Nazi art looting and restitution. And now he's one of the, I guess, I don't know, one of the world experts on it. Because I looked him up, too, but of course there's no, they won't say anything about his background, his parents, or where he comes from or anything. So I couldn't find out about that. But it did have him, as he's written books, and he's quite the expert on Nazi art looting. Can you imagine? And one of his books is The Faustian Bargain, The Art World in Nazi Germany. So he is being interviewed by Judy Woodruff. You know, Judy Woodruff, that woman that's been around in newscasting for so long. She's with PBS now, I guess. So some of the interesting things he says, he points out that Hildebrand Gurlitt, the original, the father of Cornelius, was Jewish, and he had a Jewish grandmother. Okay, so that was it. He was the one with the Jewish grandmother. That means that if that's all that was in their family, then Cornelius would only have a Jewish great-grandmother. So anyway, Hildebrand with the Jewish grandmother was just, you know, wasn't even a one-quarter Jew. He was just a one-eighth Jew, I guess, something like that. So they could work with him. They picked him out to work with, since he still had all those Jewish connections and the art connections. And he was able to continue working as an art dealer after 1933. You know, most of those Jews were. Most of those Jews stayed in the art business because there really wasn't anybody to take their place. It wasn't one of the more important areas for the National Socialists to cleanse of Jews. So they mostly continued with that. And in this guy says that in 1938, he was one of the four dealers hired by Joseph Goebbels, the Reich propaganda minister. He was actually the culture minister, too, or something similar to that, because there was another, there was Rosenberg, too. But anyway, to sell off or liquidate the works purged from German state collections. So he was just one of four. He wasn't the only one. And he had access to these works. And they make out that he held on to some 300 of them, meaning, you know, he's the thief. He's the one who kept a lot of this work for himself instead of liquidating it if he couldn't liquidate it. And I guess that National Socialists didn't care that much if, you know, he was supposed to be trying to liquidate it. And if he was unable to do so, you know, he was supposed to be doing his best. And if he didn't get rid of it all, well, they didn't really worry about it that much. That's the impression I get. And they were busy worrying about a lot more important things than that. Although Hitler did pay a lot of attention to art. And he paid a lot of attention to that degenerate art show and to things like that. So anyway, see what's important in here. During the war, when he was buying art for Hitler and the other Nazi leaders, Hildebrand Gurlitt was able to acquire these works and keep them for himself. So says this Jonathan Petropoulos. And, you know, Judy Woodruff is asking him questions. And then he says, Adolf Hitler thought that modern art was a... Here's an interesting thing. Petropoulos says, Adolf Hitler thought that modern art was A, either created by people who were physically inferior, that is, they couldn't see colors as they were and shapes as they were, and that this was a sign of racial inferiority. Well, it's a sign of Jewishness. But Hitler did say that. He did think that. He thought he couldn't understand why they were painting this stuff. You know, and he said they must not be able to see things. They don't see colors. That's why they're putting all these horrible colors together. Or they don't see shapes properly. This is kind of a simplistic way of thinking. I would hope he learned better than that eventually. I don't know if that, but that I have read that he did make statements like that. Or B, they were political subversives, this is the truth of it, that this was international art, and that, and this was art that was sold by Jewish art dealers. And these art movements that started, and I got out my big art book, my huge one today that has everything in it, and was looking at where this actually began. And it was like 1905 where these paintings first started appearing. And really one of the first was Matisse and his famous painting, Woman with a Hat. Woman wearing a hat, is it? And the main thing about it was that, well, all the features of the woman and were simplified to a great extent. There was no, you know, the finer details and everything were just ignored. And then all of the decorations on her hat and her clothing and so on were just, you know, slashes of paint and didn't really delineate anything like art used to be, had been. But basically the colors were used not in a naturalistic way. They didn't want it to be anything naturalistic. Oh, I think at this point I'll get this book up here. It weighs a ton. It's a huge, huge thing. And read this one quote from someone. Anyway, the colors were supposed to be, you used colors not at all like, you know, grass wasn't green or, a woman's face wasn't painted in colors of your flesh. And there's all sorts of bright greens and blues and reds in this. You're probably not hearing me too well because I'm looking downward. But this one here, this really explains it. If I can. This was Herwarth Walden, the editor of Der Sturm. And this was in before 1910. And he wrote, it's an avant-garde periodical. Can you hear me? It's an avant-garde periodical. And he wrote, we call the art of this century expressionism in order to distinguish it from what is not art. We are thoroughly aware that artists of previous centuries also sought expression, only they did not know how to formulate it. So here you have these arrogant revolutionaries, so to speak, who are claiming that the art previous to their new expressionism did not have any expression, did not show expression. And they now were the first ones who were introducing expression into art, and these previous artists were unable to do it, but they were now seeking out the answers and using, not doing things in a naturalistic manner was the way to show expressionism. That was supposed to express feelings and emotions that you were not being expressed in naturalistic art. So this was basically, from the Jewish point of view, and the reason that Jews were supporting it and were always a big part of it was because it was then revolutionary. You know, it was going to turn the world. It was going to turn people's thinking upside down. It was a part of all that we know that has that we identify with the Frankfurt School, which came much later. But this was starting in the very beginning of the 20th century. And Matisse was one of the first, although he never did some of the really ugly art that a lot of the others did. His paintings have a certain quality to them, but I don't think that they're worth. All these things are called masterpieces and so on because they were something new and different. And, you know, just being new and different is supposed to be enough to mean that something is brilliant. But anyway, let's go on with the story here. So Hitler was right when they all knew, the National Socialists knew that this was politically subversive art. It was it was meant to be in an international market, and it was sold by Jews. And this was enough for them to say it was not Germanic, which it wasn't, and they didn't think it was good in Germany, and they didn't want it in Germany as part of their National Socialist, their nationalist state. So all they were doing was culling it out of their museums and then trying to get rid of it. And then there was the other aspect of when Jews were had to emigrate, or they couldn't take all that with them, and so they sold their art. And now they say that they sold it at too low of prices. They were forced to sell for pennies, and therefore they need to be compensated from to get that artwork back, or be compensated for their losses, which is unheard of by any other people. Never been compensated for losses of that type. And also, of course, there's the idea that they were sent to concentration camps later on. And again, then all their wealth was acquired by the German state. And that is, there's truth to that. There's plenty of truth to that. However, the rationale that is given, or the justification that is given by the National Socialists was, and this is true too, that they had gotten so much of their financial gains through criminal means and deceitful means, and at the expense of the German people, and that therefore, you know, the German state there was nothing wrong with the German state taking what they had there and adding it to the state coffers. It was not supposed to enrich any individual. However, I believe it is true that Hermann Göring, who was a great art collector, did take things for himself when it was something that he really wanted. Probably he did, but you know, when you're that high up in the government, you might think you got something coming to you. But I'm sure he didn't. I'm sure Hitler never did that. Never, never, never. He always bought his art and paid for it. He never took anything, and he wouldn't have approved of Göring doing it. So I don't even know if that's true that he did do it, but I just kind of assume that. Of course, you hear that all the time. He did have quite a big art collection, Göring did. And either he just took it, or sometimes, or he got it cheaply. He didn't, you know. But compare this. Compare this going on to Obama and his sending drones around the world, you know, as for how evil it is. But let's go on, because I've got a lot to cover here. What does this guy... Now, later on in the interview, this Jonathan Petropoulos says, well, who will these paintings belong to? What will happen to them? Judy Woodruff asks him. He says, well... We still have to sort that out. We, he says. But we still don't have a list, and we haven't seen images of the works, which are both are very important in the restitution field. So he sees that he's one of those who's going to make these decisions, who's going to find out. He includes himself in that. Now, going on to a USA Today story, probably where it introduces this Reinhard Nemitz, who is head of the Augsburg State Prosecutor's Office. And we learn that he is, that this man, Cornelius, lived in that area. And therefore, the police there found the paintings and confiscated the paintings. And then it's in the prosecutor's office. He's the district attorney of Augsburg, and he is running this investigation into tax fraud, to see if Cornelius Gurlitt, who was in possession of all these artworks, had defrauded the government of taxes because of it, and that's what they're interested in. That's the first thing they're interested in, and they've been investigating that since the beginning of 2012 when they found these paintings, and now we're towards the end of 2013. And this has been kept quiet all this time, and now it's been leaked out. I'm not sure by who, but they're not happy about that because they say it's counterproductive to their investigation. That they say it's by no means easy to find the rightful owners, particularly when we are talking about over 1,400 paintings. So they're not, at this point, we're not trying to find out where these that information as far as to find the rightful owners, but they're only trying to find out where these paintings came from, if the Gurlitts were in honest possession of them, if not, you know, blah, blah, and if taxes were not paid when they were supposed to be, like when things were bought and sold or whatever. I'm not sure how I know the taxes in Europe are pretty stiff and pretty high and pretty serious, and they take that and they really don't, particularly in Germany, it's pretty hard to get away without paying all the taxes you're supposed to pay. They're pretty good at that. And, but this, you know, didn't satisfy the people who are interested in getting their hands on those paintings, which is all Jews. And here's where I want to point out that, the people who have been interviewed in this particular article now, and this was a good one in USA Today, is Anne Weber of the London-based Commission for Looted Art. Now, can you imagine? London-based, they say. It's just something called Commission for Looted Art. And so I looked it up. They appointed themselves to this commission, these people. It was set up in 1999. It's called CLAE, Commission for Looted Art in Europe. And they've given themselves the mandate to represent the European Council of Jewish Communities and the Conference of European Rabbis. So, you know, it's another Jewish organization that these Jews are constantly on the prowl. I mean, I've discovered they've got these groups that have been going for quite a while, and they're devoted to finding the every last stolen thing from Jews by Nazis that they can, and to get it back and to get restitution and so on. They just it's amazing what these people do, and they're calling for transparency and saying there needs to be a commitment to providing a detailed list. Because, you know, they want to go through it, and then they want to allow people to make all these claims. Well, what the prosecutor's office in Augsburg finally came out and said clearly, which I could read between the lines here anyway, was that people will make fraudulent claims. So if you put out a list and show pictures and everything of all these paintings, and then people will sit around and figure out how they can say, well, that belonged to my family. And they'll come up with, you know, maybe fake evidence or something, and hoping maybe to get lucky, even if they don't have any real evidence. Maybe they'll get lucky, but this is what will happen. And so they didn't want that, and so they kept it quiet for now. Not that they weren't going to, you know, eventually. I mean, why are these Jews in such a hurry? That's one thing. They're in such a hurry. More about this. This is a lot of this here is just repetition of what I've already said. This, you know, this came out in Focus magazine, which is a well-known in kind of breaking the news type thing in Germany, and they're the ones who broke this story. Prosecutor Reinhard Nemitz, he's the one that was under, you know, fire for keeping this to himself. Although the German government knew about it, but not, they didn't, they weren't paying any attention right away to it. He said that investigators have turned, this is his statement, investigators have turned up concrete evidence, that's the quoted part, concrete evidence that at least some of the works were seized by the Nazis from their owners or classed by the Nazis as degenerate art and seized from German museums in 1937 or shortly thereafter. So there's evidence that some, at least some of them were, but not all, not all. So okay, we have statements from this professor, German art history professor, but that's just the usual stuff here. We can pass this by. But here's some more Jews coming out. Rudiger Mahlow of the Conference on Jewish Material Claims Against Germany, and that's the one that takes care of the Holocaust claims and collects all those billions of dollars and passes them around to various Jews who are supposedly been proven to be survivors. And as you should remember, to be a Holocaust survivor, all you have to do is have lived in the area dominated, not even Germany, but area that Germans were in control of during any time during from, I guess, I'm not sure, is it 1940-something and 1945, or I don't, maybe it's even 1939, but that's all. You don't have to, show that you were suffered or you had to hide even, although they always say that. But and then you are considered a survivor who gets money. Germany has to pay you this money for the rest of your life. And this is the same organization. And he says this case shows the extent of organized art looting which occurred in museums and private collections. Well, it hasn't shown anything yet because nobody knows what it is. But that's the kind of things they say. And as I already pointed out, but I'm going to repeat here, the Jews robbed Germans to get rich, then they invested in modern art, and then they pumped up the prices of modern art, and then now they're crying and saying, oh, I had to sell my art for less than it was worth. Well, what was it worth? In times of stress and times of war and so on, everything, all kinds of things happen. But the only people that get restitution for what happened to them during times like this are the Jews. They're the only ones. So anyway, this man goes on to say, we demand the paintings be returned to their original owners, as though he knows that there's original owners, that they just assume that there's all these Jews. They're always Jews who originally owned these paintings. He says, it cannot be the case that what amounts morally to the concealment of stolen goods continues. So he's now likening this to concealing stolen goods from the original owners who deserve to get it back. And he criticized the lack of transparency and so on. And talked about Jewish families. Here you go. Which for some Jewish families constitutes the last personal effects of relatives murdered during the Holocaust. Now, he brings that out, that they have to hurry up and give this art back to these people because these are the last personal effects of relatives that there's murdered. And then there's some of these people who are going to die anytime, and they should get their paintings back before they die. Stuff like that they're babbling on about. And then there's this woman, Weber, Ann Weber. Did I mention her already? Is she the one up here? Can't keep all this straight. No. I hate to go back and look. So anyway, there's this woman, Weber, Ann Weber, who said she's the Jewish Commission spokesperson. I guess I already mentioned her. She said there had been problems with the pace of such investigations, which had become a concern for families. This here it is, where elderly members, the owners of the artwork, are dying out. So, they're rushing. They need this. They need to get this stuff back because somebody might die before they see their painting again. I'm going to skip that. Okay. It's a very long and complicated process, says Weber, to trace the looted artwork because they're in public collections or in private collections. It depends on when they come up for sale. It depends on whether the public collections have undertaken provenance research they've committed to doing or whether they've published their collections at all. In other words, it's not the simple thing where you say, oh, well, you know, I owned this at one time, so now I deserve to get it back, because if it has gone into a public collection or a private collection, it's legally belongs to that, to the owners of that. And you no longer own it unless you can show that it was stolen from you or, you know, in some way. And so all this is going to be very complicated to do it right. But they probably don't want to do it right. They want to just use a lot of publicity and emotional pushing and Jewish power to insist that these paintings all belong to Jews. And, you know, we can say, and I will say in the next hour, that this is, that a lot of these paintings are not very good, and who cares, and who even wants them? But, you know, in spite of all that, these people care about the art. What they care about is a price tag on them. And if it has a famous name, even though it's not any good, you know, it's worth a lot of money. And so that's what we're talking about here. We're not talking about art. We're talking about money. And in the art world, it's for a long time been about money. You know, it's all about money. So, all right, we're going to our break. It's time for the German swing music. Thank you. Oh, that was pleasant, wasn't it? Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager on the Heretics Hour on Monday, November 11th, 11/11/2013. We're talking about this art that's been discovered and is being called in the media, and that's just about everywhere that we know about it, that we've heard about it, is in the media. It's called, you know, an example of the Nazi looting of art from mainly Jews in the 1930s, as they were forcing Jews out of the country, or, you know, and leaving their, having to sell their art, and also the degenerate art that the Nazis culled from their museum collections in Germany, and then wanted to put them on exhibit for a while, and then wanted to get rid of them, and made some effort to sell them on the international market, but obviously a lot of them, they didn't sell a lot of them. Anyway, I'm going on now to the Wall Street Journal articles, and I have trimmed them and edited them down. So I think this one I'm looking at now was from yesterday, November 10th, and I think I'm just going to read it. It's reads pretty smoothly, and get through it in a shorter period of time that way. And it reads, Reinhold Nemitz, that's the Augsburg district attorney who's in the middle of all this, is focused on clearing up tax evasion, not on the art part of it so much. He says, we don't see our task as art historical. Now, some of this might be a little repetitive, but I think it bears repeating. And it says, Germany's federal government also weighed in last week, though, calling for greater transparency so that the artwork's provenance could be established quickly. Well, they're doing that. They weren't doing that, but they started once this came out, and the United States State Department is breathing down their neck, telling them what they should be doing. So from Berlin, the message was, let's do something more. Let's make this more transparent because of all the complaints. But Mr. Nemitz, whose team of prosecutors in Augsburg kept the art discovery secret for nearly 2 years, has made it clear he's unhappy the story leaked into the media because it makes his tax investigation harder. The 62-year-old chief prosecutor's preference for secrecy is a consequence of German legal tradition, as well as of Mr. Nemitz's single-minded personality, say people who know him. Germany has for centuries kept criminal investigations under wraps until trial. Even trials themselves were held in secret until the mid-19th century. Matthias Nicolai, spokesman for the Augsburg prosecutor's office, says it would be a crime to disclose more than rudimentary information about the case. This is the law in Germany, but, you know, who cares about the law in Germany when it's a propaganda crisis going on for Germans in the world. So it says, well, this town of Augsburg that they want to call a small town somewhere else is 270,000 people. It's famous for its puppet theater. Mr. Nemitz is renowned in Bavaria for his determined, detailed, and sometimes lengthy investigations. And one of them was years long into a controversial arms industry lobbyist for tax evasion and bribery. And it said, somebody said that Augsburg prosecutors are known for being stringent. His team relied on only one art historian to help them trace the provenance of the art, a decision which has slowed the investigation and drawn criticism from other provenance researchers who say expertise should have been sought more widely. But Mr. Koch, the law professor, says that would have led to the probe leaking earlier, which could have made it harder to investigate a wider circle of players in the sale of paintings that may have been wrongfully acquired. You see, they're trying to do this investigation without alerting people who would have been involved in it in a dishonest or illegal way to find, you know, find excuses and look for lawyers to protect themselves. They're trying to do this without people knowing what they know. But now that's all thrown to the wind. So, but Mr. Nemitz is also drawing fire for his blunt refusal now to publish a catalog of the works. If victims of Nazi expropriations or their heirs want to know whether their family's lost paintings are in the cache, the cache of paintings that they found, they should write to his office, he said last week. He said, he's an outspoken person. He said, critics can say what they want. Our central goal is to investigate crimes. Now, you know, it's too bad because this man has some kind of, some backbone. He's doing what he thinks is right. He's doing his job. He's not catering to public opinion, but he is going to be forced under the pressure of public opinion to, you know, to bend down and do what is demanded of the public, of this public opinion. So here we go on. U.S. officials continue to push Germany to handle the case more transparently. Representatives from the U.S. Embassy in Berlin met with the German government on Thursday to press their demands for more disclosure in authorities' handling of the trove. So you know that these U.S. Embassy personnel in Berlin are probably a bunch of Jews. And they are certainly on the side of the Jews, and they're doing what the Jews want them to do, demand more disclosure in this case. And a person familiar with the matter said the United States has also urged Germany to repeal its 30-year statute of limitations for the restitution of art stolen under the Nazis. So, you know, German laws aren't even safe from this, United States sponsored and supported Jewish demands that they do whatever they need to do to help the Jews. It's like the United States equals what's good for the Jews. It really does. Everything the United States does is what's good for the Jews. They're like the brokers for the Jews in all of this. So, but they still thought they could do what they still thought they had the right to run their office the way they wanted. And this Mr. Nikolai said that that they might have to rethink their approach now that the case has become public against their will, but we're in no hurry, he said. Well, another story from yesterday in the Wall Street Journal told us that there was some more art that was found, and it turns out to be a cousin. Oh, was it? Who is it? No, the brother-in-law of Cornelius Gurlitt. That's the son of the original owner, Hildebrand Gurlitt, the man now who's still living, who's being investigated, and They went to his brother-in-law's home. His sister is dead, but his brother-in-law is still there in their home. And the police collected 22 artworks wrapped in old newspapers, bubble wrap and duct tape, and put them in the back of a police car. And this man's name is Nikolaus Frazel, and but he says that he contacted the police to come pick up the art because he was concerned about security. So since all this has come out, well, there was 22 artworks in his house too. And it says, among the works in the entire collection, not the ones from this brother-in-law's house, but there is an oil painting of a girl by Henri Matisse that was known to have been taken by the Nazis from prominent Paris art dealer Paul Rosenberg. So, known, you know, I asked, known by whom? You know, the stuff they write, you have to be very cynical about it. Matisse was included in the degenerate art group, so perhaps it was taken so as not to be circulated. I don't think they took it because they wanted it, but, and who knows if this is even true, but this is something that is, somebody wrote here. They brought in this Paul Rosenberg, so Rosenberg has probably said that, or his heirs or whatever, that, that he lost this painting of, by Matisse, that the Nazis took it from him. Anyway, now we have, we're going all the way back to, I don't know if there's need for me to read this. I'll go through it. This back to November 7th. Oh yeah, no, there is, because this is a really interesting story. It turns out, and this was published November 7th in the Wall Street Journal, it turns out that a collection of works owned by this original Hildebrand Gurlitt traveled to the United States in 1956 as part of a broader exhibition. Remember, I think it was 1950 that they said, well, okay, we're going to give these paintings back to you, Mr. Gurlitt, because we can't, it seems that they do belong to you, and they gave a bunch of them back to him. Now it says in 1956, some of these paintings even were in an exhibition that traveled to the United States. And this is according to the records from the American Federation of Arts. And there is a catalog for the exhibition, and it showed that Mr. Gurlitt was the main contributor of the works that were in it. And there is a, here's the important part, there's no indication that anyone sought to claim ownership of the works at the time of the exhibition. So these particular ones that were in this exhibition went to the United States, came back again, and nobody ever said, oh, gee, I remember that belonging to my father or something. But it's not known whether what was in this exhibition are the ones in the apartment, but I would think that they would be. Okay, that's all covered. Now, this is interesting. One of the works that was returned to Hildebrand Gurlitt in 1950 was Max Beckmann's Lion Tamer. Max Beckmann was a German expressionist of a later time. He wasn't one of those real early ones, but he had really distorted and sometimes horrible torture type of, just like nightmares, paintings of nightmares. He painted around in the 40s and 50s, I'd say. And this painting of his called Lion Tamer, which I might use for the image for the show post instead of the portrait by Otto Dix that I used for the mailer. It was in the exhibition catalog, and then it was later sold through a Cologne-based auction house in Lemperz in December 2011 for 864,000 euros. Well, yeah, 2011 would be euros. $1.2 million last year. It was sold last year. $1.2 million. Well, Max Beckmann's work pulls in a high prices, very high prices. And some of those proceeds, though, went to the Lemperz auction house, of course. You know, they take a big hunk, at least 40, usually 50%. Sometimes they get 60%. And then the family of Alfred Flechtheim, the work's original owner, says, during the war, also shared in the proceeds. So Hildebrand, well, it wasn't Hildebrand, but it was Cornelius Gurlitt, who sold it, shared the proceeds with this Alfred Flechtheim. And just running wartime bombing attack in Dresden, okay. Now, through the senior Mr. Gurlitt, though the senior Mr. Gurlitt could have acquired many works before and during the war, it is also possible that he bought some of his prized pieces in the frantic months after the war ended, when many destitute art collectors would have been willing to sell their works at bargain basement rates, said restitution expert Robert Edsel, whose book Monuments Man is the basis of a film to be released by Sony Pictures Entertainment and 20th Century Fox in February. So, you know, they emphasize the idea that these poor art collectors, who were all Jewish, you know, the ones they care about, were willing to sell their works at low prices because during the frantic months after the war ended. Right? So they're talking about Jews in Germany who still had all their artwork, and then after the war they were selling them, or I don't know what they're exactly talking about here. But this Robert Edsel wrote about it, and they're making a film about it, trying to just emphasize that Jews were forced to sell their art. And I say, so what? You know, think of, here again, I'm going to bring this up. Think of the destitute Germans after Versailles who had to sell their farms and homes to foreign Jews. Did anyone say Jews should make restitution for that later on? No, not even the National Socialists demanded that. Where was the white United States then? Well, it was on the side of the Jews against Germany. That's why Hitler and his associates knew they had to take what was theirs through strength and sometimes through force, because it was never going to be given out of fairness. So much for the League of Nations and the United Nations, and also now for the EU babbling that goes on. Only fools believe this. That's the lesson to take from there. So, to just describe some of this Jewish activity going on about this artwork, David Rowland, a New York lawyer who has helped Jewish families reclaim paintings by Caspar David Friedrich and Ernst Ludwig Kirchner, said he has fielded calls from at least 30 families seeking missing art since German authorities confirmed the discovery this week. 30 families are now, and these can be really extended families because the original owners are dead and their heirs are trying to get in on the thing. And so he's got 30 families who are contacting him, who is a private lawyer, to help them with this. Rowland says, called it a huge disservice to the families to withhold any details or images of the recovered works, and called the process of mailing off letters, having to mail letters to this office in Augsburg and say, describe the artwork that you have lost, and that what it is, and they'll see if they have anything like that. He says this is just about the most inefficient way a person could handle this situation. He says, they say, clearinghouses abound in the art marketplace for tracking and cross-referencing stolen art and nearly all post images so families can see if pieces match their memories and records, their memories. Matthew Anderson is a spokesman for the Holocaust Claims Processing Office in New York's Department of Financial Services, naturally the New Yorkers, New York Jews. I said his office similarly plans to make inquiries on behalf of more than 100 Jewish families whom it is currently helping find and reclaim Nazi-era stolen art. The works are still in the process of being examined, these particular works, and German prosecutors said a list won't be cataloged or posted online. This is, again, the Nemitz office. He says, we prefer if people with the claim to lost artwork get in touch with us to say which picture they're missing, rather than the other way around. Mr. Nemitz was still defending the office's prolonged silence on the find, which was made in early 2012, on the grounds of security, citing ongoing investigations. He says this public attention is counterproductive to his case, to his investigation. But here we go again. Larry Kay, one of the world's top art lawyers, he's Jewish, said he understood that Germany's tight privacy laws may prevent authorities from publishing some salient details, but he said the rights of Nazi victims also need to be protected. Now, there you go. Always these Nazi victims, you know, they come first. They come, you know, they have, Germany has laws, has privacy laws and so on, but that should be overlooked because of these Nazi victims, so-called, they claim that they are. Kay says, I find it shocking they won't list everything they've found. Families don't always know what exactly they're looking for until they can see an image of it. And one of his clients, Marai von Sacher, is still missing 600 artworks. Can you imagine that there's some Jew there in New York that says he's missing 600 artworks that were that he lost or were stolen from him or whatever during that time of the war? Now, here's a good story. E. Randall Schoenberg, who helped Maria Altman reclaim a suite of Gustav Klimt paintings from Berlin museums in the past decade, that was a big story, said heirs of her brother-in-law, Bernard Altman. Now, Bernard Altman, that's the New York Altman department store chain, Bernard Altman stores. He obviously was not hurting financially when he left Berlin. But her brother-in-law, Bernard Altman, the heirs, are still missing several Canaletto paintings that were auctioned off by the Nazis after he was forced to flee in the late 1930s. So prosecutors have disclosed the Munich cache includes at least one Canaletto drawing, and Mr. Schoenberg said he's now determined to see what other Canalettos might also be found there. Quote from him, if they have another Canaletto, we'd like to see it because we're missing three. These people are so disgusting to me. You know, they've just, you know, that's all they think about is how to get stuff. And they, okay, I won't say any more about that. This has all had its effect as expected. And now, what we latest report that I just got from the Wall Street Journal, from Frank, was that Merkel has taken charge, and she's overruled the Augsburg district attorney. This report says, this is from today. Germany announced moves to accelerate research into the provenance of a recovered wartime art stash and said it would publish more details of the works amid international criticism of authorities' handling of the discovery. You know what the international criticism means? It means Jewish criticism. Jewish criticism. In a joint statement, federal and Bavarian authorities said they would form a task force with at least six researchers specializing in the tracing of the ownership of artworks. Works that the research indicates may have been seized or taken from Jews or others persecuted by the Nazis will be posted on the site lostart.de. I went there. It's a website of a government-backed unit that registers goods lost during the Nazi regime. Well, I went there. I couldn't, though, find any where there are any photo, any pictures of this art. As it says here, in the first step, officials posted details on 25 paintings to the site on Monday. Well, today's Monday. But I didn't, I couldn't even find the details on the 25 paintings. I was using a, you know, a automatic translated version, but it wasn't too bad. I couldn't find where this stuff was. You might have to have some special login thing to see it. I'm not sure, but I didn't have much time. So it goes on to say of the collection of roughly 1,400 artworks, 970 required investigation. Officials said, adding that 380 needed to be assessed as potential degenerate art, and 590 as works that may be looted by the Nazis. Prosecutors in Augsburg, Germany, had until now declined to make a list of the works public, amid fears it would unleash a wave of fraudulent claims from fortune seekers. Well, I think that's true. You know, I think that's very valid. But, you know, public opinion and Jewish pressure overrules all that. Now, here it says in this article, the moves by Germany's federal government and regional authorities come amid pressure since last week from the U.S. State Department for the German government to take control of the case from local authorities. And see, they don't care what is the law in Germany. They don't care what, you know, Germany is not able to run its own affairs. The State Department is clearly telling Germans what to do. And they want this thing, they want to do what the Jews want done. The State Department officials traveled Friday to Bavaria to discuss the discovery with tax authorities. That's our friend Nemitz. The German Foreign Ministry officials also met with U.S. Embassy officials to discuss the matter last week. And Chancellor Angela Merkel's chief spokesman, Stefan Siebert, sought to provide reassurance earlier on Monday, that's today, that Berlin was pursuing the clarification of the work's origins. He said, we need to find a way of publishing the artworks with dubious origins independently of the current criminal proceedings to harmonize the interests of a constitutional investigation, the justified interest of the international public, there's that international again, and possibly also of aggrieved persons. And then, Germany's foreign minister, Guido Westerwelle, now, he's the one who's a homosexual and actually married another man while he's Germany's foreign minister. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. He is such a wimp. He also weighed in on the debate, calling for transparency and warning that Germany shouldn't underestimate the sensitivity of this issue in the world. He said, quote, we need to be careful not to gamble away the trust that we have built up over many decades. Oh, yes. Oh, we're such evil. We have such a bad reputation. We have to do everything in our power to make people like us and trust us again. Still doing it, you know. They're still doing it. And it says that international guidelines are in place to assist in the restitution of works confiscated by museums, but no formal rules exist for works confiscated by individuals. So in Germany, the statute of limitations for art theft before or during World War II ran out decades ago. You know, as it should have, I say. You know, Adolf Hitler was right in telling Germans never to surrender to this vile Jew world order, because since it has, it was forced to, but the people, you know, should have continued resisting, but they didn't because they are worn out, and it didn't seem possible. But, you know, the victors here, and the United States in particular, has never let go of Germany, has never allowed Germany to function as a free and sovereign nation. And so they're not able to do what they want to do. So according to a report by the German Finance Ministry, cited in Germany's Bild newspaper, Mr. Gurlitt wouldn't have to return once confiscated works purchased by his father from museums during the war. He would not have to return these things. So he's really in the clear. But now, the finance ministry has refused to confirm or deny the report. This is where the United States comes in and is telling Germany that it must, revise its, statute of limitation for stolen art and increase it to, I suppose, unlimited. You know, no limit. no limitation at all, so that all these things can be prosecuted. Because it's all, it's too old now. It's all over. One last thing here. Mr. Gurlitt had kept out, this is Cornelius, had kept out of the intense media coverage until Saturday, when Paris Match published a photo on its website of Mr. Gurlitt shopping in Munich. So they finally found some picture of him, and a distant cousin who lives in Barcelona confirmed by telephone that the man in the photo is his relative, Cornelius. So that's it for that. I think it's quite an example of just what goes on between Germany and the rest of the world, between Germany and the United States of America, what goes on between the United States and what the Jews want, and how it's always, you know, how so much is made out of when Nazis, so-called Nazis, stole anything, or if they just took advantage of situations or so on. But in the same kind of standards are never held I'm changing pages here, so I'm lost my train of thought. Never held for the people who are holding the Nazis' feet to the fire all the time, down and attacking the Nazis. So we'll see what's going to happen with that. It'll be something I'll be interested in watching and following it. But to see what paintings finally show up and just what you can say about them. But my bottom line here is that most of this art should not really be considered any good, even though it's considered to be the masterpieces, according to the art world. But the art world has been taken over, just like everything else, going way back, at least throughout the 20th century. And, of course, Jews were influential in the art world before that, but then they really took over. And you see what happened to art. So you see what happens under their influence. I mean, art took on the intention of being part of the revolution, revolutionary. That's what I call it, modern art, starting from the first Bauhaus movement, which I'm sure a lot of the artists at that time thought this was, you know, exciting to them. But it was also directed, because those who bought it and encouraged these artists to paint this way and bought their paintings, these were Jewish art dealers in many cases, who have been made into heroes today, who supported these artists when they were you know, young and unwanted and starving, or, you know, the starving artist story and so on. They bought their paintings even though they couldn't sell them. There was no market for them, and they stocked up on them. Yeah, well, then they created a market. They created the market, and then they became worth more and more money until they're worth millions. And you just can't imagine that some of this stuff, I can't imagine that any work of art, unless it's something like a classical Greek statue or, you know, something really extraordinary that is so rare and so on. But all of these paintings by all of these 20th century artists cannot be worth millions of dollars. It's just a racket, you know. It's a racket. Well, I want to talk a little bit about whatever I called it, anti-Semitism, the rise of this whole game about anti-Semitism. And it's just a part of the same old thing, you know. It's to keep these myths going and to keep the idea that Jews are special people and Jews need special treatment and Jews need special laws and protection and so on. They have to build up this whole thing about anti-Semitism. And there's a lot that I can say about this that I've got here. I don't know how much I can get done. Let's see, Clug. Okay, well, I'm just going to start with this Office of Special Investigations. And I'm going to go to this page, which, you know, the point that I want to make, well, I didn't go there. Let's see. I didn't go there. Here it is. The point that I want to make is that the Office of Special Investigations, the OSI, no longer exists, actually, but it's on the Holocaust. There's a page about it at the Holocaust Memorial Museum website, and it talks about it. And, you know, it was started in 1979, and it continued until 2010. And then in 2010, it actually merged into a new and a different department in the Justice Department of the United States. And it was called the Human Rights and Special Prosecution Section. And it was, you know, and when the OSI was, they convinced Congress to give them, to open up this little, section of the Justice Department. It was to go after Nazi criminals in the United States who were here and they, you know, needed to be discovered. And they said that their work would soon be finished. That's how they do this, you see. This is all Jews who wanted this. And they said, well, give us this, you know, and fund us and let us be in the Justice Department. We'll get this work done and we'll be finished pretty quickly. Well, they continued for 25 years. They didn't want to stop. They kept finding new people to investigate and convincing Congress or whoever they convinced that they needed to continue, that there were still more of these criminals here. So for 25 years, they were hounding innocent American, citizens who had come from those countries after the war, and accusing them of war crimes. And they just destroyed so many families, so many lives. And the fact is, as they say here, and they're still going at it, only under a new name called the Human Rights. They're under about human rights now. But it says here that the OSI and the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum are siblings of a sort, having been conceived within the same political and moral context of the late 1970s. The museum was of great assistance to OSI, both in granting access to key documentation that the museum has microfilmed in archives in Germany, Eastern Europe, and the Soviet Union, and in the commitment of the museum to provide expert historian witnesses in prosecutions initiated and tried by OSI. The OSI played a critical role in drawing attention to the significant legal, moral, and ethical issues raised by Nazi crimes. You see how this works, you know, and we know that the Holocaust became known and even called that in the 1970s. That's when that whole thing really took off as a big, big deal where they were going to get a lot of power and a lot of money, and they got this Holocaust Memorial Museum. Now, the point I want to make is that this museum is not just a museum. It's not just your ordinary kind of museum where they want to show stuff about the Holocaust and so people can come in there and learn about it. It's much more than that. It has a lot of power, and it has taken on a lot of power using the funds that it gets, and then of course all the donations from Jews that are as large or larger than what it than the $50 million a year it gets from the United States government, and they have just increased their power, increased their holdings, bought up all kinds of stuff. They have, you know, like it talks about the microfilms and their archives, and they have It says here that Oh, no, they have, yeah, they have microfilmed archives in Germany, Eastern Europe, Soviet Union. They've just got everything there. And they play a big role in guiding and directing programs and beliefs and ideas of not ideas but about the Holocaust to in the United States. So they're really in charge of so much. They have a huge amount of authority. And it says here in December 2004, the United States Congress expanded the jurisdiction of OSI to cover post-World War II offenders, oil from other genocides around the world, and so on. Okay, so that's enough. That's enough for that. That going on from there, this Holocaust remembrance campaign. You know, the Jews are so worried about Israel. And they have, in this particular article, which I'm just going to say what's in it, they're complaining about the Anne Frank Museum, that it's anti-Israel. And if it's anti-Israel, then it's anti-Semitic. And it's pro-Palestinian, too. The people who run the Anne Frank Museum, it has a group that runs it. And they say that, and it's true, that they're very liberal-minded, pro-Holocaust, pro-Jews, and they don't approve of what Israel is doing. And so the more less liberal side of these Jews are very upset with this, and they say that this museum has become too concerned with international human rights abuses, not just with Jews, and they're very critical of that. So again, you know, this fits into the idea that anti-Semitism has become anti-Israelism, and that the new anti-Semitism is hatred of Israel. And there is a story about a something that took place just very recently, and it is a conference. There was a conference on anti-Semitism in Europe, and it was it's over now, but it just got over. And it was what happened was they had selected an Oxford University philosophy scholar, Brian Klug, K-L-U-G, as the keynote speaker. And then other Jews were really upset about this because they say that Klug he's a well-known protester of Israel in Britain. He's Jewish, and he's not, you know, I mean, he's pro-Jewish and everything, but he's critical of Israel, and he's been active in the divestment movement and all of that in the UK. So there's this big controversy going on about this man being the keynote speaker. And Klug, though, denies, his critics say that he denies Israel's right to exist. He says that that's not true. And he wrote an email to the Jewish Telegraph Agency during that weekend. He said, "My attorney has confirmed that the dossier is defamatory, that is, by this guy named Clemens Henny in Berlin, who's leading the other faction." He says that he's weighing his options, and he has he might sue about it. But he has frequently written on anti-Semitism, Klug, and he's the author of a book, Being Jewish, Doing Justice. So he's trying to be a good Jew, you know. He's one of these that you people would call a good Jew. But the bad Jews, therefore, don't like him. he's still a Jew to me, but he, I thought I had brought this in, but I'm having trouble seeing the whole thing at one time. This group launched an anti-Klug campaign, God almighty, the International Center for the Study of Anti-Semitism. Anyway, this Clemens Henney is a founder and operates this International Center for the Study of Anti-Semitism. You know, there's so many of these organizations. It's just amazing how many of them there are. And he has been very critical of Klug, and he says Klug rejects Israel's right to exist, and he says that Henney says Klug denies that there's a new anti-Semitism, which is focused on Israel, and he is affirming anti-Israel positions. Okay, so you know the new anti-Semitism, and Abe Foxman of the Anti-Defamation League talks about this too. And that is this being anti-Israel, this criticism of Israel. And, you know, of course it's nonsense to say that that's anti-Semitism. And those who are critical of Israel say that, you know, they say that there's no connection between anti-Semitism and hatred of or dislike of Israel or criticism of Israel or any other state, you know. But this Henney, no, who wrote this? Klug has written, what in any, now here's how he defends himself. What in any case can Israel do? If it is true that the community of nations is either covertly or openly anti-Semitic, what steps can it take to solve its own problem? Apparently none. If Israel is basically the victim of persecution in an anti-Semitic world, then it bears no responsibility for the position in which it finds itself. The object of widespread condemnation for anti-Semitism is a phenomenon for which Jews, neither collectively nor individually, can be held responsible. It is an a priori prejudice that revolves around a fiction, a figment of what Jews are like. It is in the nature of such a prejudice that it will always find facts that seem to corroborate its fiction. Nothing that the Jewish state does or refrains from doing could produce or prevent it. Well, this was in the TimesOfIsrael.com. But this is the way, this is kind of an interesting statement, because it is the way that Jews perceive anti-Semitism. They have, it's not about them. It's, so they bear no responsibility for it, because they've done nothing to cause it. It's a phenomenon, of an a priori prejudice about, that revolves around a fiction and a figment of the imagination, I guess, of what Jews are like. And not true at all. Doesn't have any truth in it. So if people are going to be anti-Semitic in this way, there's not anything that the Jews or the Jewish state can do to change it or stop it. Whatever point he was trying to make with that, that's an interesting portrayal of the way they look at it. Now, see, amongst these Jews, I'm kind of, I guess I might as well just go on with this. This New York writer, Ben Cohen, wrote that he did not object to the invitation to Brian Klug to be the keynote speaker at this conference, but he was concerned that his appearance in a prestigious setting would doubtless give his words extra and likely undeserved gravitas. Well, when I read that, I say, well, this Jew, Ben Cohen, wants to act as though he's you know, not against freedom of all Jews to speak or to be invited to things. But if he does speak there, it's giving him an undeserved importance, and it's not good. So he's saying he doesn't object, but at the same time he does object. Now, Klug said that he does not deny that anti-Zionism can be anti-Semitic. And he says, my work on the new anti-Semitism is intended to help us establish criteria for deciding when it is and when it is not. You see the importance they're putting on this anti-Semitism and this idea of a new anti-Semitism, and how it's going to be the center of a lot of discussion and be made into something so real. You know, I mean, it's just the more real they make it, the more people are going to take it seriously, and you know, the more it's going to seem like a real and important problem in the world. And of course it is for them, but we need to not fall for it. We need to help people to understand not to fall for this. All this talk about anti-Semitism. So let me go on a little further with this. He says, I do not deny Israel's right to exist. Well, you know, this sounds like he is critical of Israel, but he doesn't deny their right to exist. This is exactly the same with Holocaust denial. Holocaust people, those who are critical of the Holocaust, and, you know, what we call revisionists and so on, so many of them say, I do not deny the Holocaust. And this guy feels like he has to say, I do not deny Israel's right to exist. You see how that is? I mean, I don't know. How do you, if you're really critical of Israel and what it's doing, why does Israel have a right to exist? Where does that whole phrase, right to exist, come from? I've always found that very offensive and wrong. And I wish that wasn't used. You know, I don't like that phrase, Israel's right to exist or not right to exist. That's not really what it's about. Just like, I do not deny the Holocaust is not really what it's about. When you deny all the three big pillars that hold up the Holocaust, that the Holocaust people insist on, and then you say, I don't believe those things, but I don't think those things happened, but I don't deny the Holocaust. It doesn't make any sense. So they had that conference, and I was trying to find out what happened, what this Klug said in his speech, but there's no record of it anywhere. It's not funny how they get rid of that stuff. But I guess he did give the speech. I couldn't find the speech this afternoon. Now, you know, here, this is just ADL coming out and saying that, we found that the more education people have, the less anti-Semitic they are, you know. Well, they take all these polls, and they've constantly got poll results. I don't believe a single one of them. I think they just make them up. Because how do they take all these polls? And they never say who's in charge of the poll. They never say what polling company was responsible for the poll. They seem to take their own polls. They always say it's an ADL poll. Should have got to this sooner. Holocaust denial in Canada. This is really, really awful. This came from, CIC.gc.ca. I don't know. It's something pretty official. It's pretty official in Canada. Holocaust denial, they have written, may include publicly denying or calling into doubt the use of principal mechanisms of destruction, such as gas chambers, mass shootings, starvation, and torture, or the intentionality of the genocide of the Jewish people. So, again, if you question any of these things that most critics of the Holocaust do question, gas chambers, intentionality of the genocide, and so on, well, then you're a Holocaust denier, and The attempt to deny the genocide of the Jews is an effort to exonerate National Socialism, they say. So, oops, 60 seconds to go. So they are saying that, I don't know where I was going with that. I guess I was going to go look at the whole article, but I don't have time to. But this is real. Canada is becoming really insane about all of this. It's going along with what the Jews want to do, just as so much in Europe is doing, that we cannot criticize anything to do with Jews. And this is what we have to attack. And this is why I am still working on that January 27th, 2014 commemoration day for revisionists. And I've made some progress on that, and I will talk about that at another time. But if you'd like to get involved in that, write to me and tell me so. And we'll see what we can get, how you can contribute to that. So thanks very much for listening tonight, and have a good week. I'll see you again on Saturday.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.